How are we supposed to navigate our desires, fears, and longing for purpose when our culture claims that we're just born a certain way and can't help it? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is Disordered, Lies About Human Nature and the Truth That Sets Us Free. It's written by Issues Etc. guest Pastor Christopher Eskett. Learn more about Disordered at IssuesETC.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Disordered, Lies About Human Nature and the Truth That Sets Us Free.
This Easter, from our family to yours, we wish you health, hope, joy, and the peace of God, which passes all understanding.
Happy Easter, everyone. May the Lord bless you and keep you.
Of course, since that time, the Catholic universities have all become secularized. While the dogma of the Catholic Church has no sway in those institutions, the dogma of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, cannot be questioned.
The church year is just like the Apostles' Creed, stretched out over 365 days.
All of me matters to him. I can rejoice in his unbelievable love for all of me that he expressed when he died and rose. And he has saved us, rescued us, body and soul.
On-demand listeners of Issues Etc. love hearing sound theology while walking the dog.
After a recent conversation with Dr. Joel Bierman discussing his chapter in Luther's Large Catechism with Annotations and Contemporary Applications on the Fifth Commandment and lawful lethal force, our listeners had a lot of questions. Part of that was due to the fact that I failed to answer or ask, actually, a very obvious question. It didn't occur to me until I was done with the interview that I'd failed to do that. So that question got asked about self-defense, but there were other questions that were raised. And so we decided it'd be a great idea to let Dr. Joel Bierman come back on and answer the listeners' questions. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll respond to your questions and comments on lawful lethal force and the Fifth Commandment with Dr. Joel Bierman of Concordia Seminary. Elaine Donnelly joins us after that of the Center for Military Readiness. We'll discuss President Biden's executive order on diversity, equity, and inclusion and how it plays into the bureaucracy of the U.S. military. Martin Luther's pastor and confessor, Johannes Bugenhagen, I believe he died on this day, April the 20th, and he's remembered by the church. Pastor Stephen Preuss will be alongside. He's author of a column titled Lutheran Spotlight, Johannes Bugenhagen. And then we'll discuss allegations that classical education is racist. Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations, will answer those allegations. Dr. Joel Bierman is professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. He's author of an essay in Luther's Large Catechism with Annotations and Contemporary Applications. Dr. Bierman's chapter is titled The Fifth Commandment, Lawful Lethal Force. Dr. Bierman, welcome back.
It's always good to be with you.
Let's begin with Paul in Massachusetts. He begins, in his answer to the question, did Luther see government as a necessary evil after the fall? Dr. Bierman said no, and then explained his position that government started before the fall with family and that government doesn't have to be inherently negative. I wonder if he's overlooking some of the comments by Luther, especially on Genesis 2, verses 16, 17, where he calls civil government an awful remedy like amputation, and on Psalm 45, verse 6, where he goes on and on about the faults of secular government, such that, quote, one cannot find a single civil society in which there are not collected innumerable and glaring sins. They are all shot through with tyranny, stupidity, malfeasance of duty, etc. How would you respond to Paul there?
I say you've got to love Luther. Reading Luther is so rich and always so enjoyable. But the key with Luther is you have to make sure you're reading him carefully, because Luther says lots of stuff in lots of ways, and you can find Luther to say just about anything you're looking for. So you need to read Luther in the whole picture. So what I would say is there's a distinction between Luther establishing government as God's will for how creation should function, and then Luther's very dismal and dim view of how effective and capable these leaders are. He says the same thing about pastors, frankly, that we're supposed to be doing this job of proclaiming the gospel, and yet people don't, and we have pastors who are lazy and are horrible, they're like pigs. And so he can be very critical of individuals filling these offices and doesn't negate what he says about the office, but he's also utterly realistic about the brokenness of humans. And that's why he says a faithful prince is awesome, but they don't exist. If you find one in a thousand that's faithful, that's a miracle. So he's utterly realistic about the brokenness, and yet the practical realities don't negate the theology involved. And to me, that's the critical takeaway from this. And that is something I think I try to stress and we should all recognize, is that pragmatics can never take precedence over doctrinal truth. And while Luther can be utterly pragmatic about what's going on, he also holds tenaciously to the truth of things.
So what you're saying there, in essence, is that Luther did not view government as a necessary evil after the fall, but that he sees many manifest evils in the actual execution of that
government. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Here's Mark in New Mexico on Dr. Bierman's interview. I appreciate hearing him on this. I find his points good. While I think self-defense can also be defense of neighbors, I agree with him that we ought to not simply make the my right assumption and argument and think more on what scriptures and our confessions say. How do you reflect on that, Dr. Bierman?
Yeah, I'd say this is accurate, that the point is that in pursuing the good of my neighbor, it's not about me doing what's good for me, but it's about me serving my neighbor. This is critical always. And I would say that, yes, that's on the right track there.
Daryl, listening in Carlisle, Illinois, says, my question is it a sin to use lethal force to defend your own life when you're alone and no one else's life is at stake? According to Dr. Bierman, lethal force is never used for the sake of self. Does that mean you cannot protect yourself with lethal force, or simply that you cannot take justice into your own hands if you are not in immediate danger or harm?
All right. Now, this is getting to the guts of things. The premise we need to start with in all this discussion that I'm doing here is primarily not about so much trying to navigate our way through all these possibilities and trying to figure out what's right, what's wrong. Right and wrong are often very difficult to discern in the exact moment of things, but there are a few key premises that we need to pay attention to. And one of these is the idea that the Christian is called to follow Christ. And to follow Christ means we turn the other cheek, we go the extra mile, we give up what is ours. As St. Paul says, as St. Peter says, return no man evil for evil. Period. It's just unequivocal. It's just clear cut for them. Not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. And so we're called to do this. And it's not easy, but we're called to do this. So that's the first given. Then the second given, though, that makes this complicated is we have the responsibility of vocations to care for those around us. And so in the pursuit of my vocations, I need to do what I've been given to do for the sake of the other. Now, if that means I'm defending my neighbor who's being attacked, that's pretty easy. I jump in and I stop that neighbor from being harmed by evil that could be hurting him. That's legit. We'll talk more later on, because I know some questions are coming about how far that goes and what's okay and what's not, or what we should be striving for. But see, when you're all alone, it doesn't negate your vocations. I totally get that. It's not because, oh, nobody else is being harmed, now I just have to take whatever comes. No, the vocational responsibility still carries on. I'm still a father, I'm still a husband, I still have responsibilities. And if somebody is taking my life, others will be hurt by my life being lost. I totally get that. And so that's where the key comes in here is, what's my vocational responsibility over against my responsibility to witness for Christ? My appeal is simply to make it very clear that these are not mutually resolved in a simple way. And it's not like one always triumphs over the other. You can't just always say, well, you always just take whatever comes. No, but you can't also say, I have a right to defend myself, therefore. No, I have a responsibility to witness God's truth. And so we need to ask the question is, what is the best thing for me to do? So if somebody is threatening me with evil, should I try to stop that evil from happening, even for the sake of the perpetrator? And I would say, yeah, you should. Now, to what extent do I go? And so do I try to talk him out of doing something bad? Of course. And if he's not going to do that, he's going to continue to harm me anyway. How far do I go in trying to stop this? That's where you have to make tough judgment calls. And I think we can make a case for both ways of looking at this. Some guy can say, if he's threatening my life, I can go ahead and take his life. And the government certainly agrees with that. I won't dispute that. The government agrees you have that right to do that. And that right can be grounded way back. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. But the other side of it is, what would I choose to do as one who follows Christ? What's the best thing for me to do? And there, I don't think we should just go for the immediate knee-jerk reaction, well, the best thing is to preserve life. Not so fast. I think we need to be more careful and more nuanced as we think about this.
So I'll give you an example, and then I have a follow-up question on that. This was, probably 10 years ago. I was just sitting quietly one Tuesday night watching television, and someone blumped against the front door. I looked out the side window and saw a person kind of laying against the front door. I thought it might have been a neighbor. So I very slowly opened the door, realized it wasn't anybody I recognized. Turns out the fellow was very intoxicated, had been kicked out from the bar down the street, and thought my house was his house, and thought someone was chasing him. So he did some property damage out there, and then came around the back of the house and was going to try and break through the sliding glass door.
Yeah.
I called 911 the minute I realized it wasn't my neighbor, but I also went to the kitchen and got a butcher knife, just in case he came through that window. Now, just the story turned out well. The cops were just down the street, apprehended him, all's well that ends well. But at that moment, I wasn't theorizing at all about defending myself or my wife and son who was living with us at the time. I did what a father would do. And just in case he came through that door, I was ready to do him harm in order to stop him from doing harm.
Yes. And that's the dilemma we get into is, do we stop evil when we are able to do that? And I would say yes. And yet we also need to ask the question of, to what extent do we do that? So yeah, taking a butcher knife, that's a good way to defend yourself against the threat. So what would a baseball bat be?
Yes. The baseball bat was in the closet in my bedroom. I didn't have time. My son had that.
There you go. There you go.
My son found that one. Okay. The question that I think most people go to, reflecting all the self-defense scenario, is a vulnerable woman who is in the proverbial dark alley with a rapist. Is it morally permissible for her to defend herself in whatever way possible?
And the answer I would say would be yes. You can make morally yes, because she doesn't need to be a helpless victim. Nobody wants to be the doormat. And I'm not saying we need to be a doormat. And yet Christ does call us to return no man evil for evil. So what does that look like? So you could make the case that a woman in that situation could say, I won't use lethal force. I'll do whatever I can, mace, pepper spray, whatever I've got, but I won't use lethal force. And I think that would also be a legitimate course for her to take. And I'm not trying to be dogmatic about this to say that there's only one right thing to do. I think that's exactly the wrong way to approach this. I think I'm trying to make an awareness of there's a little more difficulty to this. And my encouragement is for us to think a little harder about the call to follow Christ that is entailed in these things, and not simply the rights I have as an American to defend myself.
Aaron says, overall, it was an interesting discussion referencing our previous conversation, but I was concerned by Dr. Bierman's characterization of the Second Amendment, and I think he's speaking here, of course, about the right to keep and bear arms, as a right granted by government, at one point also incorrectly saying that the rights to worship and free speech are granted by government. In fact, the very text of the First and Second Amendments make it clear that they prevent the government from making laws that infringe on rights rather than granting me rights. What's your response?
Yeah, this gets into a huge question of this whole notion of rights, which is not simply dealt with, but I want to try to deal with it at least as clearly as I can without being too verbose here. There's a couple ways of looking at rights, and the way I'm approaching this in two ways. One way to look at rights is to say, is a right an entailment that goes with a given responsibility? So if God gives an office, or in the German would be the Amt, to a certain person, and he says, you have a responsibility to do this as the prince or as the father or as the pastor, go do this. And then he also gives you the authority to carry out that Amt. Well, that authority could rightly be construed as the rights I have to be able to do this. But see, the rights are inferred in the giving of the office, not inherent. And so in that sense, I think we can talk about rights, and Luther would certainly do that. In the notion that the Constitution and the Americans' way of thinking about things deal with rights, I think is very different, because the fundamental approach that's implicit in our Constitution is the very thing that Aaron's bringing out here, is that I have these rights given to me, and this notion of an inherent right that is mine inherently. I'll push back on that. And I would contend that a Christian doesn't really think in those terms. A Christian rather thinks in the sense of grace that God gives, not in rights that I have. The sense of an inherent human dignity, I would contend, is not implicit in a Christian confession. Yes, I know we're created in God's image, and you can derive from that all kinds of ideas, and people have, but you're not going to see that exploited anywhere in the New Testament. The idea that somehow we have individual human rights that we need to be safeguarding and we need to be using, that's simply not there. We're grace functioned. We realize we have nothing we can claim as our own. We simply receive what God gives. And so my contention is that when the Constitution is ensuring our sacred rights, I think the whole premise is kind of misguided. The idea is not that I as a Christian run around claiming my rights. I as a Christian run around trying to serve the other. That's the bigger point. And so when I make the claim that the government has given us these rights, that is exactly what I mean. I would say that these are rights ensured by the government, but I would contend that the government is under no obligation necessarily to do so. Is it wise to do that? Does that make for a good government? Sure, I'll concede that and grant that. That works well. But to somehow say that I have a human right to worship, no, I don't. And see, even the idea of religious freedom, this is a fundamental right. Where? The Lutherans really don't agree with that. The idea of religious freedom means I can believe whatever I want. No, you can't. You have to believe God's truth. So religious freedom is, frankly, a non-starter from a Lutheran standpoint. And most rights talk really is a non-starter when you start getting into the depth of what actually drives Christian confession. So that's kind of what I'm getting at there. So we can talk about rights in one sense, but to talk about inherent rights, I would say is, frankly, a much more American way of thinking than it is a Christian way of thinking.
In a practical sense, Christians still want to, even if it's under the guise of human rights or some kind of inherent human rights, Christians still want to defend the neighbor in his person and in every other way they possibly can. And that may look exactly like defending his inherent rights. It sounds like you're saying the Christian needs to understand that these are not biblical concepts. They are certainly philosophical and political concepts that are very useful, very helpful sometimes, but not particularly true.
That's where I'm coming from. Yes, I would say that's correct.
Dr. Joel Bierman is our guest. We're responding to your questions and comments on lawful lethal force and the Fifth Commandment. He's professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. When we come back, Patrick has a question on self-defense as well.
Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, yet shall he live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die.
Pastor Peter Bender talking about his presentation at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference at Concordia University, Chicago.
I'm going to die. Every one of us is going to die. At the time of death, the Christian faces so many assaults. We think about the death of loved ones that causes, at times, unspeakable grief. We can be assaulted by the regret over the things that we have failed to do. We wonder about the future, what will happen to loved ones. Where shall we for refuge go? To Christ, who is the resurrection and the life.
You can meet and hear Pastor Peter Bender making the case for a dying man's consolation Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. For more information, visit issuesetc.org.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you planning your vacation in the Orlando area? Are you thinking about retiring in Central Florida? Are you looking for a faithful Lutheran church near the theme parks? Then Zion Lutheran Church and School is the place for you. We're in Winter Garden, Florida, about 20 minutes from all the attractions. At Zion Lutheran Church and School, we believe, teach, and confess God's truth for you. Find out more on our website, zionwg.org.
They've met with the pastor week after week. He's taught them our precepts and Christ Jesus to seek. He shared the law of our God, which we strive to keep, the prayers, the creeds, and the sacraments deep. Now these young saints are right to partake in Christ's body and blood, all for his sake. A gift you are seeking to commemorate this? Ad Crucem has just what you won't want to miss. We've got icons, art, ornaments, jewelry, and more. Greeting cards, crucifixes, posters, gifts galore. Your catechized friend will love what you give and treasure the gift all the days that they live.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday, April the 20th, we're responding to your questions and comments on lawful lethal force and the Fifth Command with Dr. Joel Bierman of Concordia Seminary. Dr. Bierman, here is Patrick. He says, Dr. Bierman is a respectable scholar and thoughtful man. He is, however, deeply incorrect and shows a startling lack of careful thought regarding the use of self-defense. As a father and a husband, I am bound to provide for and defend my wife and daughter, 1 Timothy 5:8. If I allow myself to be killed, not martyred for the faith, but killed by some aggressor who's targeting me for unrelated reasons, I'm betraying my family. Acting in self-defense can be a selfish act, but so can nearly every other act.
Yes, indeed it can be. He's quite right about that. But the bigger question to ask then about self-defense and the idea even of defending my family, here's the part I want to bring into this. It seems to be a taken-for-granted assumption, and we're in a sense begging the question here about what is the worst thing that can happen. Is death the worst thing that can happen to a Christian? And the answer is unequivocally, no, absolutely not. If death was the worst thing that could happen to a Christian, then we would flee martyrdom, but we don't. The worst thing that can happen to a Christian is to deny his faith or to not follow Christ faithfully. That's the worst thing that can happen to a Christian. So death is not the worst. And see, I would contend that in our American context today, there is no worse than death, which is why everybody went crazy during the pandemic, because I might die. And that can't be that can't happen. I've got to, you know, this is the whole premise of safety, safety, safety. That's the most important thing. No, it's not. Christians can't abide by that. Safety is not the most important thing. Preserving life is not the most important thing. The most important thing is to be faithful to Christ and receiving his grace and following him. That's the most important thing. So, see, and that, I think, brings an entirely new nuance to how we think about what do I need to give to my family. The martyrs in the early church went to their death often with their children with them. They held their children's hands as they went to death. If death was the worst thing that could happen, they wouldn't do that. They'd give those kids to somebody else to raise after they're dead, but they wouldn't. They didn't want pagans raising their kids. They didn't want their kids to lose their faith. That would be far worse than the child dying. So we need to rethink what the worst thing is. And so even if somebody breaks into my home and he's not doing it because I'm a Christian, he's just an idiot breaking into my home, do I now, I must kill him to defend myself. I have an obligation. I would say, yes, I have an obligation to care for my family and protect their physical health as well as their spiritual health. So to what extent will I go to do that? And I would contend that I think a Christian would be fully consistent with his following of Christ and his caring for his family by insisting I'm not going to take this person's life or aim to take his life, but I'll do what I can to stop and thwart him from doing what he's doing, which is evil. And if I die in the process of refusing to take lethal force against him, then that's consistent with my witness, and perhaps that's the stronger witness I give to my family, whereas if I compromise and violate my own confession, I in fact perhaps hurt my family by diminishing my witness. I think that case could be made as well, and I'd like to hear that case be made a little bit more strongly. I'm not saying every person who uses lethal force to defend his family is always wrong because he should have just let it happen. I'm not saying that, but I am saying we should make room for there's a little more going on here, and there's more to consider than simply save life at all costs.
Matthew has a very interesting question. He says, another possible question for you to ask in a follow-up interview, instead of who is my neighbor, I hear his interview, and it makes me ask, who is my prince? From what I heard, I don't think he would say that we can substitute the prince for the state and or the Constitution. When you might intervene for a neighbor on behalf of the prince requires he tell us what the prince translates into in our system. I didn't hear this. Who is my prince in an American context? That's fine, but he switched to the prince language several times without telling us who that is.
Yeah, that's fair. I can be more clear on that. So Luther uses prince all the time for the person who's been giving the Amt, the authority, the office of secular authority, who's got the sword. So Luther uses it all the time. So I fall into that language of prince because that simply means the guy who's got the Amt. Now, in an American context, living in a democratic republic, it's very different. We don't have a king. We don't have a Kaiser. we have given up on the idea of the divine right of kings, an idea, incidentally, that Luther would have held quite dear and would have taken for granted, which is another discussion for another time. But in reality, in living in a democratic republic, do we have a prince? Well, yeah, the prince is still the government. Every government really becomes the prince. In other words, this is the person who's been entrusted with authority to uphold the secular realm, to uphold the temporal realm, to make sure that things are working well. Now, a good government is always, Luther's clear on this, always beholden to God's truth. God sets the standard for what is right and what is wrong, not me, not the people, not 51%, not even some sort of common law that's been grounded in our long history. That's not the source of truth. The source of truth is what God has revealed. That would be a natural law kind of argument, which is, of course, expressly articulated in the Ten Commandments and in other places in Scripture and in the church's regula fide. So the truth is there norming the prince's activity, and the prince is equal to the government. So what's really interesting about the American situation is, in a democratic republic, all participants, all citizens are part of the government, which gives us a kind of a new twist. And we have to think harder about this. It doesn't invalidate Luther. I think Luther's still absolutely right and relevant because he's simply standing on what is scriptural, ecclesiological truth. He's teaching the church's truth, God's truth. And so he's right. The secular realm has the sword. But the secular realm now is the government. And the government now here in America is, in a sense, all of us. And yet we have elected officials who carry out this work on our behalf. So we have the president, and we have legislature, and we have police, and we have military. These are the people who are entrusted with the sword. The common layperson in America, or the common citizen, in a sense can be considered an extension of the government, and on occasion does rise to that position. But ultimately, the prince is simply the government.
Dr. Joel Bierman is our guest, responding to your questions and comments on lawful lethal force and the Fifth Commandment. We'll get to an objection from an attorney about self-defense in the law next.
Our desires become corrupted. They become disordered.
Pastor Christopher Eskett, author of our book of the month, Disordered: Lies About Human Nature and the Truth That Sets Us Free.
Instead of being focused upon doing what God gave them to do for us, we then become curved in on ourselves, and the desires are oriented towards something that is not wholesome or not healthy.
Learn more about Disordered at issuesetc.org.
You wish your classical school could do more for struggling learners, uncertain where to begin? The Memoria Press Schools Division includes Cheryl Swope, author of Simply Classical, A Beautiful Education for Any Child. The school's division will happily assist your school. Memoria Press offers an entire line of special needs resources for teaching math, reading, spelling, and more. Contact schools at memoriapress.com or order directly from simplyclassical.com with coupon code LPR23.
Theology for Blue Collar, White Collar, and Clerical Collar. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Martin Luther tended to view the world through the three estates, the family, the church, and the state. The family provides the fundamental unit of society. In the church, God makes Christians, and in the state, he governs for the good of his people, his church. Well, the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ affects our life in all three of these estates, and that's the topic of the April issue of the Lutheran Witness. To learn more, visit cph.org/witness or visit witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, is looking for an English teacher with a master's degree for the 2023-24 school year. Edwardsville is 30 minutes from downtown St. Louis. The position would involve teaching upper-level, dual-credit English classes. For more information, send an email to Principal Jay Krause, J-A-Y-K-R-A-U-S-E, at melhs.org, jkrause@melhs.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Joel Bierman is our guest. He's professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary. We're responding to your questions and comments on lawful lethal force and the Fifth Commandment. I'm Todd Wilkin. One of our listeners pointed out that in an essay written by attorney T.R. Halverson, When Doctrinal Review is like spell check, that Halvorsen disagrees with your statements on lethal force, namely these words, quote, Luther consistently taught is rightly used only by the one placed into the ompt of authority in the state. It is never exercised for the sake of self, but always and only for the sake of the neighbor. The Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, of course, does articulate such a right, and while not offering a rationale, the implicit foundation is the exercise of reason and the ideals of the Enlightenment. Halvorsen states that the Byzantine Empire, Rhodian law, Islamic law, canon law, Spanish Anglo law, all taught a right of self-defense. How do you respond?
Yes, that's quite right. And I should be more clear on these things. This notion of a self-defense or this right of self-defense can go way back. You can trace it through English common law. You can trace it even further back. It's there. Luther himself talks about, we all recognize the right to self-defense. So he's willing to concede this as how things work in the temporal realm. This is how it works. And by the way, while I'm thinking about this, Luther also says that a mother who watches her children being attacked by a bear should absolutely intervene, get her children out of the way. Jesus himself says, when persecution comes, go ahead and flee from the persecution. We don't need to just stand and take it. You flee, you avoid, you stop, and you even try to stop the evil when it's trying to happen. So that's there. And Luther recognizes this, so do I. Now, when I make the statement about the idea of Second Amendment being grounded in an Enlightenment idea, I'm arguing from the standpoint of what's going on in the U.S. Constitution and what's driving Jefferson's thought. Now, Jefferson is clearly an Enlightenment thinker. Hamilton, Washington, to some extent, Madison, were not purely Enlightenment thinkers. They were also very much grounded in an English common law notion, which goes much further back, and you can trace this all the way back to the Greeks to some extent. And they're coming to a consensus on, we have this responsibility or this right to care for ourselves. I would say that Jefferson has a different notion of where that comes from than do these others, but they're coming to agreement on that, which is why probably the Constitution doesn't spell it out. So I'm willing to grant you that it comes from a deeper foundation. I really think that Jefferson's notion is what carried through, because no one ever bothered to put in the Constitution, all these things have a different grounding. Everybody took it so much for granted, they didn't think they needed to include it. Now in 2023, we realize probably we should have. Now, I don't think this negates, though, my argument, because Luther himself is willing to grant a right or a obligation that leads to the sense of self-defense. I will also grant this, but then Luther will turn right around and say, but does the Christian use it? Do we take advantage of it? Do we employ that? And even though we might be given this, and a prince can claim this right, and so can an individual person, do we employ it? When should we employ it? Why should we employ it? And that's a very different thing. And my appeal through this whole conversation is simply to encourage Christians to think more like Christians, not to simply fall into an American mindset and simply do what I'm granted this right, or every American says this, and all the blogs I read say this. Wait, let's stop and think like Christians and ask the question, how would Christ have us handle these things? What does the Bible actually tell us? What does Paul tell me to do? What does Peter tell me to do? And you're not going to hear Paul or Peter ever tell you to take the sword and defend yourself. It's just not there. Now, does that rule it out? I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying let's be a little bit more careful in how we come to conclusions and allow a few more things to weigh into our thought process on these things as we're describing what is the best way forward and what is appropriate for us to do as God's people.
So you already began a little bit, but how would you summarize your basic argument vis-a-vis self-defense that you make both in your essay and that you've made here in our several conversations?
Yeah, my point is that as a citizen in this world, you have responsibilities. And even more importantly, as a creature in God's creation, which means you're a citizen in this world, you have responsibilities. You have vocational duties you need to fulfill. Fulfill those. Care for your family. Care for those around you. Intervene. Stop evil where you can. Push back against what is the influx of Satan and the evil of the brokenness of the world. Push back against it whenever you can. But in doing that, make sure that your witness is crystal clear, that you're witnessing a greater reality, an eschatological confidence we have in a resurrected body, a confidence we have in Christ making all things new, a confidence that Christ is our defense and Christ is the one who stands for us. This creates some dilemmas. I grant that. It creates some difficult spots. I grant that. But don't miss the importance of the witness that we're giving as those who follow Christ and make sure that that's paramount in all that we do. And I think that primary emphasis might lead us into some very different directions and in some different conclusions that will often be at odds with the taken-for-granted assumptions that are at work in our culture around us. Christians should be striving to follow Christ and be Christians first, and then figure out what it means to be a Christian in an American context. Don't just jump to the default American rights position. Let's do the follow Christ position and make that where we start from.
Dr. Joel Bierman is professor of systematic theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and author of an essay in Luther's Large Catechism with annotations and contemporary applications. His chapter is titled The Fifth Commandment, Lawful Lethal Force. You can purchase this new resource by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or on the Talk On Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Bierman, thank you for your time.
It's been my pleasure. God's blessings.
Elaine Donnelly will be with us from the Center for Military Readiness next to talk about President Biden's executive order on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the U.S. military.
Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry. lcms.org/deaconess.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Register today. The 2023 Lutherans for Life National Conference is October 11th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn Cincinnati Airport in Erlanger, Kentucky. The conference includes visits to the Ark Encounter and Creation Museum. Online registration is open now with early bird pricing at lutheransforlife.org/conference. Lutherans for Life, equipping Lutherans and their neighbors to be gospel-motivated voices for life. lutheransforlife.org.